would ask you to listen carefully to the title of Brother David's talk, lest you misunderstand my pronunciation. It is the Kings of the Yeast with a Y. Is that better? No. Somebody has their monitor on. Okay. All right. The Kings of the Yeast with a Y. The Kings of the Yeast. Brother David.
Before we begin, Brother Ray and Sister Bonnie Santiago wanted their love brought to this convention, which I don't think I specifically did yesterday, and they wanted to give special thanks to the Columbus, Ohio Ecclesia for the letter which they sent them. I'm sure you all realize that the church is eventually called the Kings of the East. However, at this season of the year, I think we all realize we're never going to be kings of the East unless we have control and reign over the East. And so we must be kings of the East before we are kings of the East. And since Brother David's talk ceased with the admonition, we'll pick it up right where he left off, to do away with the leaven, with the yeast, with the sin. John says that all unrighteousness is sin. And I'm sure all of us, as is all the world, recognize obvious unrighteousness. But there's something we have to do much beyond that. We have to look for and recognize the direction of unrighteousness. We have to, as the Hebrews did, seek out the yeast, the leaven that hid in all the dark places of their houses. I've been very much impressed with one statement that Jesus said when he saw Nathanael coming. And he said, "Behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom is no guile." How would you like to have Jesus say that about you? I think we all would. To the best of my knowledge, he said that about no one else. So it must be a very rare quality to have no guile. Well, that word guile means a decoy or a trick or a bait or a subtlety. So apparently a lot of us tend somewhere in us to have some decoys, some baits, some subtleties, some tricks. We aren't always exactly what we appear to be. That's called hypocrisy. And of course Jesus made a point of saying that leaven represented hypocrisy. What we'd like to do this hour is to look into some of the corners of our experiences and see where yeast might be hiding and how we might be able to sweep it out. I'm going to break it down into several categories. And the first is ourselves in the harvest. I think anybody who's familiar with the history of the Harvest Church knows that this movement, like all reform movements, has suffered some sort of a decline. Reformers always are full of energy and zeal, and their children are almost, and their grandchildren, third, fourth generation down the line, have become rather nominal. And we are in that point in the Harvest Church where it's so desperately easy for that to happen. And of course, nominality would be a form of yeast. And so all of us would like to see a revival of the spirit of the early Harvest Church. We'd like to see what it was, what it is not, and try to bring that back into our lives. I think what it was might be summarized in about five generalities. I think back in Brother Russell's day, it was a joy of understanding. I think it was a passion to share. I think there was an ever-present propensity to overlook. I think there was an energy for self-change. And I think there was a hunger for being together. I'm sure there were other things. But all of those things were part of that spirit that pervaded the early Harvest Church. But joy of understanding maybe has deteriorated to disputes over subtleties. That's leaven. The passion to share maybe has degenerated to witnessing as a duty. That's leaven. The propensity to overlook faults in others perhaps has deteriorated to classification of brethren. That's leaven. The energy for self-change perhaps has deteriorated to self-comfort or self-righteousness. That's leaven. The hunger for being together perhaps has degenerated to ritual and habit. And maybe not, maybe in some cases isn't there at all. I couldn't help but think yesterday, what would the Last Supper have been like if only seven apostles showed up? It's an interesting event, wasn't it? I'm sure the account of it would have been very different. I don't know of absenteeism being reported in the early church. There's no account of that. You see, we don't have any scriptures to deal with that. It wasn't needed. But maybe there's some sort of leaven that creates that situation, something to keep in our minds. I'm sure also everybody in this room realizes that the revival of a spirit of anything can be done only one place, and that is in ourselves. It cannot be done to others or for others. So as we look at these problems, we can look only one place, and that's inside. We can't look at the brother or sister sitting next to us. We can only say, what can I do? What am I doing? We can promote God's way only by example. Even all the discourses, as rich as they have been with information, if you aren't ready to receive them, they've done you no good. You could get the most eloquent speaker here to deliver the most eloquent discourse for 75 minutes every day, month after month, and it would make no difference. Only in ourselves can we make a change. Knowing that, I think we also have to know that whoever it is that's sitting next to us is a different part of the body. Because too often when we try to change ourselves, we're expecting other people to change in the same ways. And we can't do that. Body has bones. A body has tendons and ligaments and sinews. A body has muscle and a body has fat. And it's all there for a reason. And some brethren are bones and they're rigid. And if you're looking for them to bend, you're looking for the wrong thing. What happens when a bone bends? You don't want to break your brethren, do you? But if you're looking for one of your brethren who forms the function of being fat in the body, zeal, something that gives a lot of heat, and in some sense a lot of nice cushion, and you want that brother to be rigid, well, have you ever seen rigid fat? I don't think so. But the individuality of the body, as well as its unity, is one of the things that we celebrate at the memorial season. That's why we can only work in ourselves and not in others. Because everyone plays a different part in the body. Too often now, the Harvest Church has deteriorated to an attitude of disgust when they look at each other. That's a sad situation. I've been trying to summarize the attitude of the New Testament and of Brother Russell's writings as regards how we look at ourselves and look at others. And about as small as I can reduce that concept, I think it is that we must be liberal toward others and conservative toward ourselves. And I think the early Harvest Church had that, the propensity to overlook what it saw in others and thought might be false, because they understood that they may not be false at all. They may just be stepping stones in that person's development. Liberal toward others, conservative toward ourselves. Throughout the history of Christianity and other religions, there has been one force that has always been a problem, and that force is fear. And so we have to look at ourselves in this time of self-examination to see if the leaven of fear is present, because fear is a terrible force for good or evil, because we have good fear, don't we? We call it reverence, and we have bad fear. How do we tell the difference? I think bad fear... Well, let's take good first. Reverence, good fear, promotes activity in relationships. Bad fear does the opposite. It's about as simple as we can make the difference between the two. Good fear promotes activity and interrelationships. Bad fear constrains. It does the opposite, restrains. What kind of forms does this take? Little subtle directions of yeast that come into our existence. I'm sure you have all been in the midst of brethren discussing this problem, that direction, this project, that project, and someone will say, well, we can't do that because it will lead to that. I don't think that's legitimate. I think that's fear. I'm afraid to spend 10 cents because I might spend $10. But if you spend 10 cents, you may not have to spend $10. I'm not talking about money. I'm still talking about the relationships we're in ecclesia, where one brother said, please, let's try this. And the other brother says, no, because that will lead to that. Does everything have to lead to something? It's not right. That's a leaven in our reasoning. I feel sure that that attitude is one of the things that resulted in the present state of the Watchtower Society. And I think that is one of the things that now results in divisions amongst brethren. Fear. Fear to allow the other person to live out his consecration in the way that he feels the need to do. Why do we all have to live everything out the same way? Bone and fat do not respond the same. Fear is manifested in dogmatism, which is another yeast. Because anybody who is confident does not have to be dogmatic. If you really understand, you can allow others to express their opposing opinions. It's only if you really fear your own faith that you fear to have others express theirs. I'm sure you all realize that you're busy. This is a period of the church and of the world where busyness seems to be something that is a plague. When Brother Russell discusses Christianity and how it keeps people busy in order to keep them uninformed, I couldn't help but apply that same principle to our lives, that Satan and society can keep us busy to keep us uninformed and unchristian. The doctrine of meditation is something greatly neglected. We need time to stop and think and meditate. The text in Revelation that points out there would be an hour of temptation says that it would try all those that dwell upon the earth. I think that's important. It gives that as the reason for the hour of temptation, to try all those that dwell on the earth. The suggestion is, it will not try you if you don't dwell on the earth. So, if the hour of temptation is getting to us, we have to stop and say, is the leaven of dwelling on the earth entering our lives? I know we have to make a living. We have to do a number of things. But maybe if we're being tried by the hour of temptation, it's because we are dwelling on the earth, which means our connections with this world are a little too strong. Well, that's self. Let's look at family and friends, unconsecrated, as another source of places we might find yeast to be swept out. I have seen a tendency grow, and it's always been present during my consecrated life. I don't know how far in the past it went, but it has grown considerably. I see that among a number of brethren. Let me just throw out some silly generalities. I'll make some things up. Suppose your son is a drug dealer. Suppose your sister is a prostitute. Suppose your father is a thief. What's your attitude toward them? I have seen, not those instances, but similar instances in the family and friends of brethren, things that brethren were, quote, ashamed of, unquote. And I think they took exactly the yeast road to deal with it. There is a difference between accepting something and condoning it. If your son is a drug dealer, he is very, very, very well aware of the fact that you do not condone that. You probably never even have to say it, and he's very aware of that. So there's absolutely no point in demonstrating that you don't condone it. He knows that already. But if you show your understanding, obviously you can't understand illegalities, but if you show your understanding for the person's place in life, their problems in life, you're going to do them a whole lot more good than if all you do is avoid them and criticize them. That's where Jesus happened to find a number of early disciples, was by going into places nobody wanted to go. Everybody in this world has something rotten in him. So what? So do we, or did we? So, if your daughter runs off and lives with somebody without getting married, she knows you don't like that. Are you going to disown her? Or are you going to pretend she's your daughter and mean it? Think about that. It's not a case of compromising the truth. It's not a case of condoning error. It's a case of realizing that here is another person you're going to have to work with during the millennium. Start working with them now. Brother Russell has the same thought. Let me quote from Volume 6, page 114. The mediator takes mankind as he finds them. By the way, you're supposed to be part of that mediator. The mediator takes mankind as he finds them and will deal with each individual of the world according to his own particular condition, thus adapting himself and the laws. Notice that. The mediator adapts himself and the laws to all the various peculiarities, blemishes, weaknesses, etc., as he finds them. Why don't we do that now, so we're ready to do it later? Leaven sneaks in, doesn't it? You know, righteousness is so much on our mind that as soon as we face something unrighteous, we push it away. Well, go ahead and push the unrighteousness away, but don't push the people away. There is a difference. People need love and compassion. Let's take a look at the world and see if there are instances here where we can find leaven in our ways. Subtle leaven. Our relationship with the world should reflect one thing primarily. I'll summarize it as the joys of Christianity. That's what the world should see in us. Let me tell you a little story, a true story. You may know the brethren involved. Brother and Sister Langer, formerly from Chicago, I think they're on the West Coast now. They're Jewish. And at one time in their experience, they were really quite interested in looking into the Bible, obviously from a Jewish viewpoint. And they moved to a little town in Illinois, and a delivery man came. And the delivery man was one of these people just bouncing with joy and smiling and happy, and delivered their goods and started talking to them about some woman standing on the moon clothed in the sun. Well, you can imagine what that does to a Jewish mind. No familiarity or anything. Is this man mad? No, that was not their reaction. Matter of fact, their reaction was to gain a tremendous respect for this brother, who was a brother. And while they didn't find their initial witness about a woman standing on the moon clothed in the sun had any reference to them at all, they saw the joy of Christianity in that man. And because of it, they were baptized in his tub. And they are now our brethren. But I think that above all has to be the way the world sees us. Anything else comes across as leaven. It comes across as hypocrisy. Because if you believe something and it doesn't show, that's leaven. Preach. Not preach because we're supposed to, but because we can't contain ourselves. I'm sure you know scriptures like Isaiah 61, the Spirit of the Lord God is upon me because he hath anointed me to preach good tidings. Or Psalm 40, verse 9, which says, I have preached righteousness in the great congregation, though I have not refrained my lips, O Lord, thou knowest. Fairly rare usage of the word preach there. You can check Strong's out on that. But I think it shows the joy of Christianity that's involved in that preaching. The word means to be fresh, that is, rosy, figuratively cheerful, as in one announcing glad news. Now, how do you announce glad news? Knock on the door and, hi. No, it isn't how you announce glad news. You almost tear the door open to tell somebody what wonderful things have happened. And that is what we are supposed to look like to the world. So each of us must look into ourselves. I know we're not all bubbly personalities. I'm not. But even quiet joy can be seen by the world. And if it's not there, let's find out why. What kind of leaven is sitting in the way? I think it's important. Now, this statement can be misunderstood. I think it's important to make friends with the world, not of them. A distinction. Make friends with the world, but not of them. You know, James said, friendship of the world is enmity with God. You're not making friends with the way they do things. You're not making friends with their principles. But can't you make friends with them as people? And if you don't, there is no way under the sun that you're going to give an effective witness. It's impossible. How many of your enemies do you listen to? Let's look at the Ecclesia and the Brotherhood for other places where we might sweep out some yeast. Unfortunately, in past years, recent years, apparently much more than in the past. The ecclesias have had The ecclesias have had the necessity of conducting church trials because of inappropriate behavior of some of the members of the ecclesia. It's only appropriate that that should be done under proper circumstances. But here, again, sits a big bowl of leaven just ready to be dipped into. Because we can do things which are right by the letter and wrong by the spirit. And I think it's imperative that when we do what's right, we do it right. Satan should never be the victor in a church trial. That's not the point of a church trial. The point of a church trial is the rescue of the erring one from his problems and the blessing of all. That would suggest that a church trial does not have deadlines. We don't say, I'm going to meet next Sunday from 2 to 4 and decide this matter. That may be impossible. You just set up a situation where Satan can enter with all the leaven, spread it on the cracker, and feed it to you. It's imperative that a church trial have only consecrated present. It's imperative that those consecrated brethren are aware of the fact of confidentiality, because they are not there to publish a newspaper about what the erring one has done. Quite to the contrary, we're supposed to hide each other's blemishes. We have to realize that here, above all places, is an opportunity for responsible compromise. You can't compromise truth, you can't compromise principle, but you can certainly compromise the way you use it. And if you have a whole ecclesia that has to come to one unified decision respecting Brother X, who has to be dealt with, you're going to have to compromise. There's no way that the elders are going to see alike or the brethren are going to see alike. And so they've got to talk and pray and meet with no deadline to decide for an answer they can live with. The person who has erred does not always have to be present, because the church is not always dealing specifically. Obviously, he has to be present sometime during the church trial. But not always, because sometimes the church has to decide how to handle it, and that person sitting there listening to the church bickering out a compromise is not going to get the desired blessing. There again, the leaven can enter, which allows a person not to be sure where he stands. And above all things in a church trial, what must come out clear is that the whole ecclesia agrees that this person needs this action. It can't be with variance. It can't be with shakiness, with hesitation. It has to be positive. The object of this church trial is always the unity of the church for the good of the sinner. That's what it always is. So if the church trial does not have unity within the ecclesia, it's a failure, no matter what it does in regard to the person who's erred. And remember, the hardest part is not making the decision. The hardest part is living with it after it's made. But that's also the most important part, because if you want to help the person who's erred, you must put up a united front for as long as necessary. Another opportunity for leaven enters this particular situation by brethren who don't live in the affected ecclesia. We have responsibilities to accept that the decision made by such and such an ecclesia was correctly made and go along with it. We don't live there. We don't know the details. We don't know why the ecclesia made the decision the way it made it. Why do we have to put our 2 cents worth in? Unless you want a national church trial for everything that happens. So what's left? There's only one possibility left, and that is say, I respect that ecclesia. What they decided, that's what I will observe until it's completed. Anything else is leaven the leaven of pride, thinking that we know better. All right, let's take another occasion for a little yeast. And I will plead guilty in the past for having had a big dose of this particular yeast. I don't get any blessings from the meeting. What kind of pride do we show when our central question is, or our central thought is, the meeting is supposed to give me what I need? Well, of course it is. You can't erase that thought. But approaching a meeting that way, we'll have 100 people sitting in the meeting, all with one thing on their mind only: themselves. No meeting will be blessed with that attitude. We live at a time that we are seeing the results of the natural causes of history. A lot of the ecclesias that exist today sprang up in the 1930s and 40s. And a lot of them have brethren in them who grew up in Depression years. The traditions, the practices of those years, the tendencies of thought of people who grew up in those years have some similarities. But we are sufficiently past that in the 1980s that the ecclesias now have a rather large influx of brethren from a different generation, a different tradition, a different way of thinking. And you find related dissatisfactions. Now, there are two things you can do about that. Basically, only two things. You can satisfy those dissatisfactions, or you can let things get worse. I think the latter is leaven. Because a lot of the things we do because we've always done them. And when Brother X says, "Can't we try it this way?" and everybody says, "No, we've always done it that way." What does this have to do with the unity of the body? Nothing. Nothing whatsoever. If somebody wants to study that subject, and somebody wants to study that volume, and somebody wants to study that problem, have three studies. If somebody wants to study it topically, and somebody wants to study it chronologically, and somebody wants to study it some other way, have three studies. What's the problem with that? I don't see any problem, except habit, entrenchment, leaven. Remember, the only things that are sacred are scriptural truths, not the way we do things, except where the scriptures specifically state that they must be done that way. Let's talk about learning. Because in the ecclesia, that's one thing we do. And of course, we could learn the way we learn when we go into a college classroom and say, this semester we're going to cover this book and you're going to pass a test on it. But if we bring that into the church, that's leaven. Because here's how the church should learn. And actually, this is how all of us should learn, even in a college classroom. Three steps. Number one, you fall in love. You're not going to study anything adequately if you aren't interested in it. You must say, "Oh my, there's something there that's beautiful." That's the first step in learning. If you don't see that when an ecclesia is starting to study something, that's the first thing you have to look for. You have to examine for something you can fall in love with and relate it to your life. Because that's the only way a doctrine is going to become personal. After we fall in love, we dissect things. We cut them up in little pieces. And we look at all the little pieces. And that's still not learning. Part of it. The third thing we do is we reassemble the whole. Sometimes experience helps us do that. So after we've fallen in love, dissected, and reassembled, we have learned something. Now, of course, the whole ecclesia can't do that at a time. But that's how we learn individually. And when we look at each other, sometimes some of us are in the dissecting stage. Some of us are in the falling in love stage. You know, if somebody's falling in love with somebody and you start telling them all about things that, little details that don't make a whole lot of difference, they're not going to listen to you. They're seeing this wonderful picture they've fallen in love. And you make a criticism, don't criticize, I've fallen in love. So a person who's just fallen in love is not going to be terribly involved in the dissection part of learning. And the person who's terribly involved in the dissection part of learning is not going to be very involved with the person who's put it together and sees the whole big, broad, beautiful picture and is really quite tired of detail at that moment. But just remember, your brother and all in different places. Talk to them about the part that's important to them. Some see details, some see totality. Probably that was never more manifest than in the 1960s issue on the reign of Christ. And instead of understanding the fact that there were really more than two viewpoints, we love to pigeonhole. You're that or you're that. That pulls down the shade, all discussion ends, you're on one side or the other, and 80% of the brethren don't even know what's being talked about. Some brethren can see two sides and favor one side of a discussion. Some can see two sides and they don't favor either side. Some can only see one viewpoint, and that's most of us, face it. But that's a dangerous position, a position where leaven can enter so easily, because then you tend to discount everything your brother is saying because you don't know what he's talking about. Or you might think you do, but unless you can explain it clearly, you don't know what he's talking about. Then there are some brethren who can't see why the whole issue is being talked about in the first place, that it's wasting time. But that's just as legitimate, because everything does not appeal to everybody. It's the criticism of these viewpoints that's leaven. No one of these brothers is any less a Christian because he sees one side, the other, the whole thing, or nothing at all. Brother Russell said that nothing except secular matters can be excluded from discussion in the church. Obviously, he didn't mean you can intrude anything in the discussion anytime you want. I'm not meaning that. But if somebody needs something discussed, it should always be discussed not with the attitude that, oh my, let's get that out of the way because it's wrong, but with the attitude that, let's look at it, let's see why, let's see what the scriptures say. Actually, you might change your mind someday. I've changed my mind on a couple of things, and I don't find that a weakness. Isn't that what the Bereans did? Search the scriptures daily to see if those things be true. Not search the scriptures daily to see if they can prove those things false. Very big difference. I'm going to quote a secular writer, because he says in one sentence what I think Brother Russell says in all of the sixth volume. It's Thomas Jefferson. He was dedicating the University of Virginia at the time that he said this. Quote, here we are not afraid to follow truth wherever it may lead, nor to tolerate any error so long as reason is left to combat it. I think that's Brother Russell's philosophy. If you discuss any truth openly, sincerely, you're not going to lose it. You're going to enrich it. Another place where leaven can come in is in how we weight our sources of learning. You know, in Ephesians, the second chapter, the 20th verse, it's very clearly stated that we are built upon the foundation of the apostles, prophets, and the Lord. That's the foundation of our faith. But it is also very evident in Revelation 1 that Jesus held in his hand seven stars. Clearly, those stars had a very different place in our learning than the prophets and the apostles and the Lord. But they were held in his hand. They were directed. They were guided. I don't think, of course, I know you have any way to judge this, but I don't think anybody loves or respects Brother Russell's place in the church more than I do. I am a fervent supporter of him and his place in the Harvest Church. But to be so, I must rely on scriptural authority above quotations from the seventh messenger. Because if you prove anything by the seventh messenger, that's yeast. That's guile. That's not what we want. Obviously, you're going to prove him right because he was right. But don't prove him right by quoting him. Quote the foundations, the Lord, the apostles, and the prophets. Then you'll be strong in your love and respect of his place in the church. There's a good, better, and best of this. It's good to know what Brother Russell says. It's better to know why he said it. And it's best to know the texts that prove it. That's the reason for a seventh messenger, to lead us to those texts and to understand them. We are celebrating Jesus. You can give him thanks for Brother Russell, but celebrate Jesus. Another place for leaven that has been very manifest in recent years is the false concept that the Lord is isolating a body who perfectly understand the truth above their brethren. I don't know how many brethren actually say it that way, but they do it that way. They split and divide and divide. Why? Because we're keeping the truth pure. If that were not so pathetic, it would be very funny. The Lord is not isolating a body of people who perfectly understand the truth above their brethren. We don't purify the truth. The Lord does that. We purify ourselves. What kind of pride? What disastrous kind of pride? What mountain of leaven is going to say, I and the three who meet with me are holding the truth pure over all of you who are sitting out there in those chairs? When you think of the audacity of the concept, it's sickening. Division is almost never a testimonial to our principles. Division is almost always a testimonial to our carnality. And that's not David Duran. That's Paul the Apostle that says that. Always keep in mind, there's a difference between having the truth and having a good relationship with the Lord. Your relationship with the Lord obviously improves with the amount of truth you have, but just because you have the truth doesn't mean you have a good relationship with God. Because we have what is right does not make us right. Let's look under doctrine and prophecy as an area where leaven can be growing in the corners. Doctrine and prophecy cannot be separated from Christian growth. It is yeast to separate them. So, in one sense, you see, you cannot really legitimately say, are we going to study doctrine or are we going to study character? No, really, there is no legitimate division line between the two. Why have we studied? Why have we pored over the Greek, the Hebrew, the concordances, the everything that we can get our hands on? Is it to be scholars? No, it's to be Christians. That's simple, isn't it? Always keep that in mind. We are not scholars, we are Christians. The scholarship is a wonderful bolster to our faith, but we are not scholars, we are Christians. 2 Corinthians 3:2, Paul says, ye are our epistle, known and read of all men. Now, this ties into what we said earlier about the brother who knocked on the Langer's door with all of the vibrant smiles and enthusiasm he had. This brings us down to the relationship of our smiles and enthusiasm to our doctrine. Because how do we preach? How are we led? By knowing doctrine? No. We are led by living doctrine. Let me read the Apostle's words to Titus, a text that's always been extremely dear to me. Second chapter, verses 9 and 10. Exhort servants to be obedient unto their own masters, and to please them well in all things, not answering again, not purloining, but showing all good fidelity. Here's the important part. That they may adorn the doctrine of God our Savior in all things. Adorn the doctrine. Adorn the doctrine. Decorate the doctrine. Dress up the doctrine. And Paul shows in the context what he means by adorning the doctrine. He says, live it. Don't say it. Live it. How do we do that? Let's take some doctrines. Let me start with the ransom, rather fundamental doctrine. Sure, you can explain the ransom. You can put it on a scale. You can show Jesus equals Adam. You can show all kinds of things. But the appreciation of that doctrine was best shown to me by a story a brother told, which really makes the point. Put yourself as a prisoner in front of a judge's desk. You've been found guilty. And the judge says, the sentence will be your life. We will take your life away. And you plead for mercy. And the judge says, all right, I'll make an exception. Give me your son, and we'll kill him in your place. And that's worse. And you plead for more mercy in front of the judge. And then the judge says, all right, I'll have my son slain instead in your place. How would you feel about that judge? Not that you'd take him up on it, but that's what's been done for us. Now what's the ransom? Is it one for one? Oh, sure it is. But what does it do to your responsibility? What does it do to the consecration of your life from that point forevermore? Let's take the doctrine of restitution. You know what restitution is. We all know what restitution is. But what's the effect of that doctrine? Does it not give us a different relationship to our fellow human beings, to our enemies, to the poor, to the handicapped? They're no longer just things. They aren't the poor. They aren't the handicapped. They aren't our enemies. They are somebody with whom we will be dealing shortly and can deal with them consequently very differently at the moment. The doctrine of restitution gives you a genuine desire for the end of this order. So when you pick up a paper or watch the news and find out monetary systems are collapsing, it doesn't bother you. You begin to adorn the doctrine. You don't worry that your retirement funds are invested in thus and such an investment, do you? Because if we do, there's a little leaven there. This, more than anything, is probably the doctrine that creates that all-pervading Christian joy. We are dying so that others may live. How about the Jubilee? It's not just a tool in determining the second advent of our Lord. No, if we are living the Jubilee, we've heard everyone hearing the trumpet. And we sympathize with them. We cooperate with them. You don't complain about your Social Security taxes going up, do you? I hope not. I know that's not the restitution that God has planned, which will make Social Security look terrible. But isn't the spirit the same? What about AIDS-dependent children? What about food stamps? What about charities? What about busing? What about women's rights? I know there are many things which have elements in them with which we do not sympathize. But if we recognize it as part of the Jubilee trumpet, rejoice. Not because it's for us, but because it's for that poor world that is only beginning to see the fore gleams of being let free from their chains. The spirit of these things is correct, not the way they work. Some people say, oh, but there's corruption in food stamps or corruption in aid to dependent children, whatever. Of course there's corruption. Pen's imperfect. What do you expect? But what's the choice? The choice is you have no help and therefore no corruption, or you have help and therefore corruption. Which is the better choice? I'm not up here pushing political and social ideas. What I'm up here is saying, be sure leaven hasn't entered our brain and that we react with the rest of the world and find fault rather than find good with whatever we see. What about cleansing the sanctuary? It's an interesting prophecy. There again, if we have studied the chapter on the cleansing of the sanctuary, you can understand it, you can diagram it, you can document it, you can give all the history, but that's not living the doctrine or the prophecy. Living the prophecy of cleansing the sanctuary means something more. It means a holy regard for what we have been given and what everybody had to give up in order to get it. It means a holy regard for the place of the seventh messenger. It means an appropriate hatred for error. Not for those that hold it, but for the error itself, a distinction that's very important. What about church organization? You study that. Do we live it? What has it done to our being, to our thought processes? Has it given us a love for priorities and protocol? Have we learned from it to adorn our place in life rather than to aspire to something different or to criticize those in different positions? Now, I think it's important to realize that you never elected elders to defend the truth. You elected elders to help in the Christian growth of all in the ecclesia. Now, those of you who have not had that marvelous opportunity might not understand what happens when you try to do that. You see, your elder might sometime look like he's walking the fence. But you must realize, he isn't up there to say amen to your viewpoint. He's up there to help everybody in front of him who happen to be sitting on extreme sides of different questions. We're not saying the brother who's the elder doesn't have an extreme view. Maybe he does. But that's not his place to sit there and pound it. His place is to that entire flock which he is feeding. Am I done? I'm done. Okay. One more. You've studied the three covenants. You've probably even argued about them. But have you adorned them? The three covenants deal with Israel, with the church, and the world. I hope in studying those covenants, you've come to love Israel. You've come to love the Lord's church. You've come to love the world. That's the point of those covenants. They're a love arrangement. That's what they are. And if in studying those covenants, you haven't come to love Israel or your brethren in all their differences or even the world, you've failed your study of the three covenants. You've missed the point. John 8:32, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Of yeast, hopefully. No, we'll all try to see where yeast lies in the corners. Always question what we're doing. Don't become habitual. Habitual things prohibit growth. We're supposed to be growing, even if we've been in the truth 98 years. May the Lord have his blessing.
Thank you, Brother David. We really appreciate the effort that went into that to remind us of our real intentions, some of our real intentions that are we should have in our growth as Christians, to conform ourselves in the likeness of our Master, something that is certainly in the forefront of our minds at this time of year. At this time, we will be dismissed for lunch, and once again, All of you brethren are invited to share lunch with us. Lunch will be in the same location as yesterday, and if you're not here yesterday, we will leave the building by the main doors outside of the auditorium and go down the sidewalks to a building I believe called Union Hall, sort of on the right side. Let someone go first. You can follow them, and it's very easy to find. Please come and share lunch with us. We'll close with Brother David's choice, number 273, The Lord, a Sun and Shield. Again, we'll ask you to please arise on the final verse. We'll ask Brother David to dismiss us with prayer, asking a blessing on our meal and fellowship.
Holiest of all, our kind Father, please bless us with thy Spirit, that above all we ask, that we might serve thee and see the accomplishment of thy plans and purposes. Bless us now as we share together the things of thy word and partake of temporal nourishment. We thank thee for being able to be together and ask thy continuance in Jesus' name. Amen.